Hi everybody, my name is Ken Fallon, and several of you have contacted me to see if Hack Republic Radio could do anything to mark the passing of Aaron Schwartz. In that period of time, I was listening to the commandline.net where Thomas Gideon featured a speech by Cory Doctorow, who was on a book tour for his new book Homeland, and instead of talking about the book, gave possibly one of the best and more moving speeches. Thanks to Corey and indeed Thomas for arranging the use of that clip here today. Links to the various different websites can be found in the show notes for this episode. But first, a few moments of silence.
So, hi, I'm not going to read from the book because there's podcasts of me reading it in which all the places where I habitually make mistakes have been edited out, and so they will sound better than me reading it to you in person. Instead, I will talk about what English teachers inevitably call the themes of the book, although the only book that can be properly said to have a theme is the novelization of Spider-Man, which has the Spider-Man theme. I'm going to talk instead about the ideas in the book, and it takes the form of a kind of recent history lesson that starts in February of 2010 in a town called Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, which is an affluent suburb of Philadelphia, the kind of place where they can afford to give MacBooks to all the students. So all the students get free MacBooks, and they take them home every night, and they bring them back to school every morning. Their homework assignments are given to them over the network. They turn them in over the network, and this is the only device they're allowed to use at school. So it's kind of a mandatory laptop. And in February 2010, a student named Blake J. Robbins brought a lawsuit against the school district because his high school principal had called him in and said, "Blake, you're taking drugs." And he said, "I don't take drugs." And his principal said, "Well, can you explain this?" And showed him a photo of himself the night before in his bedroom taking what looked like a pill. And the young man said, "Well, that's not a pill. That's a Mike and Ike's candy. I eat them all the time. And how did you get a picture of me in my bedroom?" And that's where the lawsuit kicks in. What we found out is that the school quite correctly assumed that the students would have their laptops stolen or that they would lose them, and so they put some anti-theft software on the laptops. Now, in any other world, we would just call the software spyware, because what it let them do was activate the camera over the internet and take a picture that they could see without the little green light going on. And, you know, Anton Chekhov, he says, if you put a gun on the mantelpiece in Act 1, it'll go off by Act 3. If you give school disciplinarians the power to spy on students in September, by February, there'll be a lawsuit, as it turns out. And so there was this lawsuit. And as the lawsuit unwound, we found out that they had not only taken this picture of this one kid one time, but of course they'd taken thousands of photos of many students that they suspected of being discipline issues in some way, including photos when they were undressed, photos when they were at home and at school, photos when they were in the company of people who weren't students, their parents, other kids, their siblings. And in the wake of it, the school promised, and all the laptop schools in America that were doing this reformed their ways such that they would no longer do this. They would no longer secretly install software that let them covertly take photos of kids in their schools. Instead, they announced that they had installed software on these laptops that they could use to take pictures of these kids. Because, as you'll know if you've studied your panopticon, you don't have to tell people that, or rather, you don't have to hide the fact that you're spying on children in order to terrorize them into obedience. It actually works better if you tell them that they can be spied upon at any time, because then they'll internalize the surveillance, right? The Germans, they called it the policeman inside. So let's move to Germany. 10 months later, September of 2010, when a group of fun-loving, freewheeling, hacker, troublemaker types called the Chaos Computer Club, who were the right kind of troublemakers, getting the right kind of trouble, they outed the government of Bavaria for secretly installing software spyware on the laptops of people that they suspected of being some kind of disciplinary issue. And this software, they called it the Bundestrojaner, or state Trojan, like a Trojan horse. The Bundestrojaner, being 10 months more recent than the stuff they were using in Lower Merion, could do video, could do audio, could grab screen grabs and keystrokes and plunder the hard drive. And moreover, as CCC showed, that once you reconfigured that machine, the infected machine, so that it betrayed its owner, it presented many risks to the owner, because not only could agents of the state use the Bundestrojaner to spy on an infected computer's owner, but anyone else could too. You could go to a Starbucks or any other place where people gathered on a single wireless network, use your laptop to scan for infected systems, and then hijack those systems too. You could ride piggyback on the state intrusion. So now we'll go to September 2012. In September 2012, the Federal Trade Commission settled with 8 companies. 7 of these companies were in the rent-to-own business. They rented to own life's necessities to people who couldn't afford to buy them outright and were willing to pay for them 4 or 5 times over in order to possess them because they felt that they needed them to participate in society. And of course, the top suspect for that used to be cars. These days, it's laptops. So these 7 companies, they rented to own laptops. The 8th company made laptop security software. They're called Designerware. They were based in Northeast Pennsylvania. You can probably tell where this is going to end up, right? So the settlement with the FTC, the 8 companies stipulated that they'd use Designerware's product to spy on the customers of the rent-to-own companies, and that they'd not only taken stills of them, but they'd recorded video of them, and they'd recorded video of them having sex. They'd recorded video of their children in the nude. They'd intercepted lots of private communications, emails and communications from doctors and HMOs, privileged communications from lawyers, stuff from their bank, their financial records, as well as their passwords. They'd audio bugged them, and they'd plundered their hard drives for any files that looked interesting. And the FTC, they settled with these 8 companies, and they're the consumer watchdog agency, so they did what you hoped they would do. They forbade them from doing it anymore. They said, you can't do this anymore, you must stop it, unless, anyone want to guess? You tell them, right. Yeah, if you disclose it in the long, gnarly, useless hairball of legalese that you have to click through so many times a day to participate in 21st century society, you can basically do anything. Now, Consumer Union, they tell us that it would take 27 hours a day to read through this legalese. So you can be pretty sure that nobody reads all of it, but I think most of us read none of it. And there's a good reason that you never read it before you click I agree. The first reason not to read it before you click I agree is that if you've ever read one, the one thing you can be certain of is that you absolutely don't agree with anything in it, right? Because they all boil down to some version of, by being dumb enough to use this product, you agree that we're allowed to come over to your house and punch your grandmother in the mouth and wear your underwear and make long distance calls and eat all the food in your fridge, or a local equivalent, you know, insert the Twitter or Facebook or Gmail equivalent here. And so we don't read them because why bother? And we don't read them because the worst thing that they could do to us is what? Kick us off the service, make us get a different Gmail account. Big deal, right? Well, maybe it's worse than that. Because in 1986, Congress passed the first major anti-hacking law in this country, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And rather than list all the things you weren't allowed to do under the law, which would have been a long list and obsolete by 1986.5, instead, they just said anytime you exceed your authorization on a computer that doesn't belong to you, you do something you haven't been permitted to do, everything not forbidden is mandatory, you are in violation of the law and you can go to jail, you're a felon. So along comes federal prosecutors who put 2 and 2 together. They go, well, on the one hand, we've got this long list of stuff that you're forbidden from doing in the terms of service, and on the other hand, we have a statute that says when you do something that you're not authorized to do, you're a felon. And then we have these people who do things that we don't like, and we can bring felony charges against them for violating the terms of service, because everybody's always violating terms of service. And guess what? People plead guilty when you do that, because people plead guilty when you indict them, period. 97% of the people who are federally indicted in this country plead guilty and never argue their case. So either our prosecutors are the greatest prosecutors in the history of the human race, and they're so psychically good at their job that they only get it wrong 3% of the time, or there's something rotten going on, or there's coercion going on, where the threat of extended sentences in a horrific and inhumane prison system that's so overcrowded the Supreme Court has ordered California to start releasing prisoners who haven't served their sentences, because no matter what they've done, they don't warrant the kind of human rights abuses inherent to being shoved into our overcrowded prison system. that people are willing to plead out to 3 years in jail rather than face 50 years in jail and the prospect of bankrupting their families on the way to defending themselves. There are people going to jail now for Computer Fraud and Abuse Act violations because they pled guilty, people whose crimes are things like adding one to the number at the long web address when they were looking at their AT&T customer record, discovering that that if you did that, you were looking at someone else's AT&T customer record with lots of confidential information that could be used to compromise them, outing AT&T for bad security practices and finding themselves in the receiving end of a federal indictment for their trouble. But there's someone who didn't settle out, someone who was indicted under the CFAA as well as other statutes, who I'm going to talk about briefly tonight, someone who helped me write this book. Someone you've heard a lot about lately for reasons that are not very nice, an old friend of mine named Aaron Swartz. Now, I met Aaron in around the year 2000 when he was just a little kid. He was 14, but he looked younger. And he was one of these prodigy kids who his parents didn't bother sending him to school. They kind of homeschooled him for certain values of homeschool, which just means like he was bright and they turned him loose and said, go learn stuff. He was very curious. One of the things he got really interested in was how the internet worked. He got involved in internet standards bodies where they hammer out the technical specifications of the internet itself. Though the standard he was taken with was something called RSS 2.0, without getting into a lot of details, is a way that computers on the internet can talk to each other, which is what every internet standard does, approximately. There are many standards like it, but this one was Aaron's. And so Aaron got involved in this stuff and participated so meaningfully on the mailing list. They didn't know he was a kid. They invited him down to the meetings. They started to say, you should come out. You know, we do face-to-faces in San Francisco and the like. You should come on out. And he had to say, you know what? I don't think my mom would let me because I just turned 14, right? And so after they got over their shock of the fact that this was a 13-year-old who'd been helping them out, they really wanted him to come out, right? They wanted to meet him. And luckily for them, there was a reasonable facsimile of an adult on this mailing list, a woman named Lisa Rhine, who's terrific and was my girlfriend at the time. We're still great friends. And she offered to chaperone him as kind of a representative from the standards body. And so his parents would put him on the plane in Chicago where he lived, and we'd pick him up in San Francisco where we lived, and we'd squire him around town. We'd take him to the meetings, we'd take him out for dinner, we'd introduce him to nice people, we'd marvel at his horrific, horrific eating habits. Aaron only ate white food. French fried potatoes, boiled potatoes, pizza with nothing on it, boiled rice but not fried rice because it wasn't white enough, white toast. And you know, you'd hear him talk and you'd go like, this is a very bright kid, and if he doesn't die of scurvy, he's really going to go somewhere. 2005, he joined the company Reddit. They gave him the title co-founder. He contributed some pretty important code to Reddit and made it the site that it are today. When Reddit got bought out by Wired and its parent company Condé Nast, they moved him into the Wired magazine offices, where he did not thrive. He was not meant for a desk job. After a series of breathtaking and escalating acts of public disobedience and insubordination, he was shown the door and wished all the best, which is precisely what he went on to do. In 2008, he got involved with a federal database called PACER. Now, there's two kinds of law in this country. There's the congressional law, the statute books. You've seen the I'm Just a Bill Schoolhouse Rock video. You know how that works, right? And then there's the pointy end of the law, the judge law, which is the law that the judges make when you argue your case in front of them and they weigh your case in the balance and read what the other judges have written about other cases like yours and utter an opinion, issue an opinion in which they write down. Now, all the statute books are a couple of good-sized bookshelves, everything that Congress has passed since 1776, but the judge law is a couple of good-sized libraries, everything judges have written since 1776. So historically, it's been hard to lay hands on it because there's a lot of it and it's expensive to reproduce. And yet, to know the law is to read the judge law. It's not enough to read the statute books. Those of you who are programmers, the statutes are the requirements document. The judge law is the source code. You need both, right, to understand the law. So in the 1980s, PACER took the judge law online. It was an early federal database to put this online, and they charged 7 cents a page. To understand how antiquated this was, it was measured in pages. Somehow, they decided that there was a thing called a page of internet. And so they charged by the page, 7 cents a page, which, you know, given that you might have to look at hundreds or thousands of pages, especially in the 1980s when 7 cents was 7 cents, could add up, right? And you know, but they had to pay for the computers, which were big and bulky and stupid and expensive, and the specialized skills that it took to administer, and the enormous bales of hay that the brontosauruses that powered the wheels by going around and around 8 day in and day out to keep the PACER system running. But by 2010, 2011, 2012, it was kind of an anachronism, right? Because now computers are fast and cheap and small, and you could run the whole thing off a DS. You know, you could seed it on the Pirate Bay with 1,000 seeds and let anyone download their own copy of it. But instead of making it cheaper, for some reason they made it more expensive. It went up to 10 cents a page. So some people at Princeton, some activists, they decided that they would make Pacer public. Because there's a funny thing about the law, which is that it doesn't belong to anyone. It's not public property so much as it's no one's property. You can copy the law, you can share the law, you can make copies of the law, you can charge money for the law. You can do anything you want once you have the law. So they created a service called Recap, Pacer backwards. And the way Recap worked is you plugged it into your browser. When you went to pay for a page of Pacer, first it would check to see whether that page was in Recap. And if it was, you got it for free. You got the copy from Recap. And if it wasn't, you paid your 10 cents, and your page went into Recap. Aaron liberated $1.5 million worth of federal law, the 20% of law most widely cited, and put it, and it ended up in Recap, which we all thought was completely cool and amazing. The FBI did not think it was cool and amazing. They staked him out, they opened a file on him, they began surveillance. Then they brought him in for questioning without his lawyer present. And this is a public service announcement. If anyone from any law enforcement agency would like to speak to you, you should ask to have a lawyer present. I said this the other night when I was giving this talk in San Francisco. This is a 24-city tour. In San Francisco, I said this, and a woman came up afterwards to get her book signed, and she said, by the way, I work for the FBI. And I said, oh, cool. What did you think of my advice that no one should talk to the FBI unless they have a lawyer present? She said, that is excellent advice. So there you have it from the horse's mouth. Don't talk to the FBI without a lawyer present. Don't talk to law enforcement without a lawyer present. That's what Aaron did. He didn't talk to the FBI without a lawyer present. He got off and was fine. But it didn't end so well the next time. In 2010, Aaron got involved in another big database project. This one was with a database called JSTOR, where we store all of the scientific and technical articles published in the journals. Most, if not all, but most of these things are publicly funded. They're either coming out of public universities, government agencies, public research institutions, or private institutions with public funding. So we paid for the science, and the science is the truth of the world, right? It is our best understanding of how the world actually works. Scientists mine crumbs of reality all day long, and they publish it, and it gets aggregated in these big databases. So if you want to know the truth of the world, like, say, when someone comes along and says, you should vote for me, I know the truth of the world and I can make it better, and you want to find out whether their theory of how the world works conforms to our best available evidence, you should be able to see this science, especially since you paid for it. And you should also be able to see this science because we never know who's going to make something cool out of science. Last week I was listening to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's As It Happens. They had a young man from Baltimore on the radio who had been spelunking around JSTOR and found an article on carbon nanotubes that gave him an idea for detecting pancreatic cancer early. And you may know pancreatic cancer kills most people who get it because we detect it so late, it's too late to do anything about it. He spammed Johns Hopkins Cancer Research, sent out 1,000 emails, 999 of them were unanswered. One of them came back from a researcher who said, this is not an entirely stupid idea, we should talk about it. The reason this kid was on the radio is because it worked. They're shipping. Right? An early test for pancreatic cancer. And on the radio, he said, I don't know who's going to have the next great idea, and that's why I think what Aaron did was so important. So JSTOR, the journal articles are either free for you if you're at a big research institution or a fancy private university or a well-funded public school or a very well-funded private school, but otherwise, you have to pay for every article, whatever the journals charge, $10 to $50 an article. And so it's kind of weird that we have to pay for our science. So what did Aaron do with this science? Well, by 2010, he was a fellow at Harvard, and down the road, up Massachusetts Avenue, there was another big, well-funded private institution, MIT. Aaron started going over to MIT, where they have this very progressive policies. Anyone can hang out at MIT. You should. If you're ever in Cambridge, Mass., go hang out at MIT. It's great. It's like real genius, but real, right? You can use their Wi-Fi. They make it public. That's cool, too. And their Wi-Fi, best of all, hooked up to JSTOR. You can access JSTOR all you want while you're on campus at MIT. They pay for that. So here comes Aaron, and he starts downloading thousands of articles on MIT's network, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. The network administrators try to shut him down. He plays cat and mouse with them for a while, trying new ways to get around them. And then finally, I guess he figured enough was enough, so he broke into a wiring closet on campus at MIT. Now, when I say he broke into a wiring closet at MIT, you probably think he like defeated the biometric locks on a level 3 biohazard containment facility. But it's not like that. The closet that Aaron broke into, his nefarious breaking and entering method was turning the doorknob. And this wiring closet was one in which many people turned the doorknob. A homeless guy kept his clothes in it. Aaron went in and he plugged his laptop straight into the network and started downloading articles by the million, which is when they caught him and when they charged him with Computer Fraud and Abuse Act violations, and when they told him that they thought they could put him in jail for 50 years. But Aaron didn't settle. He had money. He thought he was in the right. After all, what had he done up until that point? He was entitled to the articles. He just downloaded them automatically, and he plugged his laptop into the network, right? So are we really going to put someone in jail for taking too many books out of the library? That's crazy. Plus, he knew some good lawyers. You know, he was hanging out with Larry Lessig. He fought it. But they fight dirty. They issued a press release. They said, we're going to put him in jail for 35 years because stealing is stealing, whether you do it with a crowbar or a laptop, suggesting that federal prosecutors not only don't understand laptops, they also have only a vague understanding of crowbars. But they also they started to bleed him out. They wouldn't give him the documents to which he was entitled. You know, his defense would go and request these documents that he was supposed to get right after the indictment, and the judge would order the prosecution to turn them over, and the prosecution wouldn't, and they'd send the lawyers back to do it again and again, running out of money, right? Starting to have to ask friends for money to continue his defense. It was rough, especially considering that now he was looking at this 35-year indictment. It was pretty hard. But he kept fighting, and he fought a crappy internet copyright regulation called SOPA, which you will all be familiar with. At least you'll know that there was a day last year when none of the kids in America could do their homework because Wikipedia went black in protest of SOPA. Remember this, right? So when I was in D.C. like a week before SOPA, and I talked to people, and the general consensus inside the Beltway was don't bother. There are enough congressmen and senators who've taken enough money from the affected industries and who've been told that they will get no more money the next election cycle, that this thing is going to pass. You can't beat it. Decide instead what you're going to do in a world in which this is law. But that was a crappy answer. And groups fought it. Groups here, New America, and Public Knowledge, and CDT, and ACLU and so on fought at the American Library Association, but all these little activist groups across the country sprang up to do it too. There was the group Aaron had founded, Demand Progress. There was another group out in Cambridge, Mass, Fight for the Future, EFF, some of the usual suspects. And together, all these different groups and ad hoc coalitions beat SOPA. And they beat it through all kinds of groovy, cool, new activist moves, right? Like not just sending petitions to Congress, but, you know, SOPA, it had this provision that said, if you have a website where people are allowed to talk to each other, a message board for your Little League team where you talk about who's bringing the Gatorade and who's got the carpool, you were responsible for policing it for copyright violations. So if someone posted something, you had to make sure it didn't violate copyright. So somehow you, as some person whose like main expertise was coaching a Little League team, had to be able to understand the nuances of copyright law. But not only that, you had to make sure they didn't link to a place where copyright infringement was going on. So if someone links to Tumblr, now you somehow have to look at all the things on Tumblr and make sure that it doesn't infringe copyright. If you do that, I'm here to tell you there are things on Tumblr that you will never unsee no matter how hard you try, right? But it went even beyond that. There was like one draft of this that said, you are responsible for policing it so no one links to places where they are linking to places where copyright infringement takes place. So as soon as someone links from Facebook to the message board or message board to Facebook, you have to make sure nobody ever links from Facebook to the Pirate Bay. End of the internet as we know it. It becomes the next generation of cable TV. Companies can talk to us. We can't talk to each other, and we never get to say a word back to them. So one of the groovy activist moves was to create a widget where if you had a website that would be killed by this, a place where people could talk to each other, you could put up a little piece of JavaScript, and when people visited your website, it would say, hey, hi, you've heard of this SOPA thing? Yeah, I'm going to have to shut down if it passes. What's your zip code? Oh, okay, well, here's your congressman, and here's your senator, and here's a button you can click to call them up right now. And we put 8 million phone calls through to Congress. And they realized that no matter how hard it is to get reelected without campaign funding from major donors, it's much harder to get reelected without votes. And that was the end of SOPA. And it was great. And we celebrated. And we partied. And we were proud of ourselves. And I think Aaron was proud and pleased of himself, too. But clearly, this stuff weighed on him. They would meet with the prosecutors. And the prosecutors would say, there is no deal on the table that doesn't involve jail time, $1 million fine, and a felony conviction so you can't vote, you can't hold office, you can't be a doctor, a teacher, work with kids. In the congressional hearings that just went on into this, the prosecutors intimated that one of the reasons they did this was that they felt that it would be embarrassing, having indicted him, not to have him go to jail. They wanted to make sure that they wouldn't lose face. So last January, about 6 weeks ago now, 2 years to the day after Aaron's arrest, Aaron killed himself in his apartment in Brooklyn, which you probably already know. So here I am going around with this book. As I say, Aaron helped me write. And I'm trying to figure out what to say about all of this stuff. And one thing I know is that Aaron did none of this because Information wants to be free. I had a long heart-to-heart with Information, and it confessed to me that the only thing it wants is for us to stop anthropomorphizing it. Because Information wants nothing, but people want to be free, and you make people free with good information. You make people free with the law. Knowing what the law says makes you more free than someone who doesn't know what the law says. You make people free with science. Knowing the truth of the world makes you freer than not knowing the truth. You make people free by letting them know what their devices are doing so that they know that they're not betraying them or spying on them or doing something terrible to them that compromises them. But in this country, we don't make laws that assist that. In this country, we make laws that stand in the way of it. Like in 1998, we passed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA. The DMCA is another parade of horrors that I could talk about all night, but I'll just call your attention to the anti-circumvention provision. It says that if you make a device that has a lock that the manufacturer put in it to stop you from doing something, kind of the computer equivalent of selling you a fridge with a butter dish screwed closed because you didn't pay for the butter dish feature, that removing the lock, changing the computer, the device, so that it does the thing the manufacturer would prefer you not do, is illegal, even if doing that thing isn't. And it's illegal to tell someone how to remove the lock, and it's illegal to tell someone what they need to know to figure out how to remove the lock. So you might have a phone that's locked to the Apple Store. You might have an iPhone or an iPad. And removing the lock is illegal, right? So that you can install software that Apple hasn't put in the App Store. Maybe it's the app that tells you every time a drone kills someone in Pakistan that Apple rejected because they don't want people thinking about drones and people dying in Pakistan when they use Apple products, right? Removing that lock is illegal. Telling someone how to remove the lock is illegal. Well, kind of. The Copyright Office, every 3 years, it holds hearings into maybe we should have some exceptions to this. So they made an exception to allow you to jailbreak phones but not tablets or iPods. But that exception doesn't include to making circumvention tools to unlock your device or telling someone how to make it or using them or sharing them. So if you can unlock your iPhone without doing any of those things, it's legal now, but it might not be legal in 3 years. But it's not totally illegal unless it's an iPad. Right? Or maybe you have a Nintendo 3DS, right? And this is the device that lots of kids carry around. It's a game device. These are the devices that are in our living rooms and that are in our pockets and have the potential to compromise us in all kinds of ways and that are thousands of times more powerful than the computers you were using 10 years ago. Maybe you've got a Nintendo 3DS. The Nintendo 3DS has a little thing in it that locks it so that you can only run software that Nintendo has put in its store and collected some money for. And so if you want to play a homebrew game or a game that someone wanted to sell you without having to give Nintendo a cut, you have to unlock it. Every time you turn on your 3DS, it tries to connect to the internet and call the mothership to see if there's a new operating system for it, even if you don't want it to. And having found it, it downloads it and installs it, even if you tell it not to. And once it's installed it, it reboots itself and checks for tampering. And if you've tampered with it, it switches itself off, and it never switches itself on again. That's the end of your 3DS. And it's illegal to find out how that lock works, tell people how that lock works, or disable that lock. So security researchers, they go around and they find out how our devices work. They find out about the bad stuff lurking in them that compromises us in a thousand ways. Because your phone fills your pocket, and you take it with you into the most intimate contexts, and it knows who your friends are, and it knows what you say to them, and it knows where you've been, and it knows every one of your secrets. And so to find out whether or not it's an honest servant, you have to take it apart and see what it's doing. And researchers who do this are quite rightly afraid that they'll get into trouble, like Trevor Eckhart, who found out that the carriers had put spyware called Carrier IQ on 141 million phones that they sold to the American public. He found this out because he was looking at Android phones, which are legal to take apart because they're not as locked as the Apple phones. And then he later found out that it was in the Apple phones too by examining for the traces that he knew what to look for once he'd found this in the Android phones. This spyware could capture all of your keystrokes, including your short messages, your passwords, and so on. It could plunder your files, including your photos, and it could know where you were and send all this to third parties. And when Eckhart went public, he faced legal threats because he was embarrassing these companies that now paper over this by putting it in their terms and conditions. So when I gave this talk in Seattle at the start of the tour, a woman put her hand up and said, "You're scaring me. How will I make my devices secure?" And I said, "You won't make your devices secure. I won't make my devices secure. No one of us can make our devices secure. But if I just finished telling you about waterborne parasites, you wouldn't say, 'How will I make my water supply secure? Where will I get the water filtration plant? How will I inspect the sewer system and make sure that it's not going awry?'" Right? We regulate water with gravitas. We regulate it like it's a matter of life and death, because it is. But networks are matters of life and death too, and yet we regulate them like they were fax machines attached to waffle irons. Like they were the next version of cable TV, mobile phone 2.0, the world's greatest pornography distribution system. Not like the nervous system of the 21st century, a time when everything we do involves using the internet, and a time where shortly everything we do will require using the internet. We fail to treat these with the respect that they deserve. So why do we do this? Why is it so rotten? Well, the cliche, which is, I think, true, is that the system is corrupted by money. If you are a lawmaker, your job is to get reelected, and the way to get reelected is by raising a lot of money, and the way to raise money is by making rich people happy, and the way to make rich people and companies happy is by passing laws that make them richer, and with their additional riches, they can give you more money to get reelected. Lather, rinse, repeat for a few election cycles, throw in Citizens United, and the next thing you know, it's a felony to find out what your computer is doing. Right. So when I wrote this book, I wanted there to be in it a election campaign that wasn't based on money, where people used computers to figure out how to get elected by people who liked their ideas rather than by people who thought that they would make them richer. And so I asked all these different election strategists that I knew, people who'd worked on Dean, on Obama, people who worked on Republican campaigns, what's your best shot at using computers to get elected without a lot of money? And what they gave me was interesting, but it was inside the beltway and inside the box. So I wrote to Aaron thinking, oh, in a couple of days he'll shoot me some bullet points, some stuff. I bet you he's thought about this. Now, an hour later he shot me back a full-fledged design document for what he called the machine for getting votes, a way to use social media and networks to put votes into a campaign based only on the candidate's integrity and the voters' wish to see that candidate in office. And it was so good, it was shovel ready. I pasted it straight into the book, all except for the last two sentences, which were, "Gotta go, I'm gonna go do this now." And the last code he checked into GitHub before he died was clearly related to it. So we get to decide. Here we are making the future, and we get to decide. Are we gonna have a future where the computers listen to us, where their default posture is yes, master? Or are we gonna have a future where the computers boss us around, where their default posture is, "I'm sorry, I can't let you do that, Dave." Right? We get to choose. We get to choose, are we going to use free systems where it's legal for people to figure out what's going on in them so shenanigans can be detected and corrected? Or are we going to use systems that are locked, where nobody is allowed to tell us if they find something rotten going on in them, where they might compromise us in a thousand ways? Because the world is made of computers. Remove the computer from most of our buildings, and those buildings become uninhabitable. What that tells you is that buildings are, in fact, specialized cases for computers that we happen to live in, right? Your car is a computer that hurtles down the road at 50 miles an hour with you in it, surrounded by other humans trapped in computers, likewise hurtling at 50 miles an hour. The 747 I flew from London, where I live, to Seattle, where I started this tour a couple of weeks ago, that is a Flying Sun Solaris workstation in a fancy custom aluminum case connected to some badly secured SCADA controllers. So not only do we live with our bodies inside of computers, we're putting our computers inside of our bodies now. So some of you, like me, are Walkman generation. Some of you are iPod generation. We will all log so many punishing earbud hours that there will come a day when we'll need hearing aids. When we get those hearing aids, they will probably not be retro hipster beige plastic analog transistor numbers. They're going to be computers that we insert into our bodies that will know what we hear, that will be able to stop us from hearing things, that will be able to make us hear things that aren't there, and to tell people what we're hearing. So we have to get this right. We have to know we can trust our computers. Unless that sounds futuristic and far-fetched, let me tell you that it's actually a toned-down version of what's already here. Because last November, just a few months ago, a researcher named Barnaby Jack gave a presentation at an Australian security conference on implanted defibrillators, which are amazing technology. If you have a heart condition and the doctor thinks that your heart is going to lose the rhythm and you'll die as a result, she can anesthetize you and cut you open and reach into your chest cavity, spreading your ribs, and attach a computer to your heart with its own little battery, and the computer will listen to your heart beating, and if your heart misses the beat, it will give you a little shock that brings you back, right? And doctors, well, they want to know what this thing is doing after they put it in your chest cavity, and attaching a wire to something that is inside your chest cavity is messy. And so it's got a wireless interface, and that's where Barnaby Jack comes in, because from 30 feet away, he can detect your defibrillator and reprogram it, so it seeks out other defibrillators to reprogram, and he can cause them to seek out other defibrillators to reprogram, and then either at some random time or at a set moment in the future, they can deliver lethal shocks to their owners. So this is not something that will become a matter of life and death. This is a matter of life and death. Now, I asked Aaron for some other help with this. Both this and the book that came before it, Little Brother, have a series of afterwards, two afterwards each. The first one has an afterword by the cryptographer and security expert Bruce Schneier, who explains why our bad security thinking means that we get nonsense security measures that make us less free and less safe. The other one was by a hacker, a hardware engineer named Bunny Huang, who, when he was a grad student at MIT, broke the security on the Xbox and made it so you could boot the Linux operating system, GNU Linux operating system on it, so that you could run your own programs on it, use it as a computer. He wrote a great book about it that you can download for free or buy in stores. It's called the Hacking the Xbox. Great title. It says, does what it says on the tin. And it explains how to be a reverse engineer, how to think like a reverse engineer. For this one, I got Jacob Applebaum to write one of the afterwards. And you may know Jacob as a volunteer for the WikiLeaks project. He's also a volunteer on the Tor project, which is a project that builds censorship-resistant, surveillance-resistant network tools that are used by dissidents, by radicals, by people who work in Fortune 100 companies where they block Boing Boing, by students, to get around censorware and to get around surveillance. He wrote a great editorial or a great afterword about writing code that makes us more free, using technology that makes us more free. And then Aaron wrote me an afterword, and he wrote me an afterword that's a letter to someone who is thinking about how to make the world better, explaining the mindset that went into defeating SOPA and what you can do to fix it. And in the end of it, he writes, it wasn't supposed to happen this way. A ragtag bunch of kids typing on their laptops is not supposed to be able to stop one of the most powerful forces in DC. But we did it, and we can do it again. But it only works if you take part, which is really the message of this talk. It only works if you take part. We get to choose what future we are going to live in. You can choose to use free and open source code and free and open source devices, but you can also choose to help us understand the public health issue that is networks. So you can join organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and Creative Commons, and you can give money and energy and time and join the mailing list of organizations like the Campaign for Democracy and Technology, like the New America Foundation, like Demand Progress, Aaron's group, like the Fight for the Future Coalition. They all need your help. They all need your time. They all need just your name on a mailing list so you call your senator at the moment when it does the most good. All of those are ways that you can substantially help. And what's amazing is that there are so many of these groups that I could rattle their names off all night, because 15 years ago, there was a bare handful of them. And now this has proliferated because everybody is starting to understand that this stuff matters, because everybody is starting to see that networks matter in ways that go beyond cable TV or the profit maximization strategies of the internet or the wiretapping fantasies of the security apparatus. And so people are joining this struggle every day, and it's what makes me hopeful for it. And I hope you'll take part too. But before I finish the talk and move on to questions, there's one more thing I'm going to talk about. It's a very short bit, a coda. And the reason it's short is it's not a subject I'm any kind of expert on. But it's something I told Aaron's family I would talk about when I told them I was going on the road with this book. And it's suicide and depression. So people do get depressed. And sometimes it's easy to tell why you're depressed. Sometimes you're under a 35-year indictment. Sometimes you are have money problems or romantic problems or job problems. Sometimes you've got problems with abuse or alcohol or substances. Sometimes it's something in your past you can't exactly recall. Sometimes you may not even be able to put your finger on it. because maybe it's just bad chemicals. It's hard to tell sometimes. But whatever it is, people get low. And you can get so low that you may think you'll never get up again. You may find yourself in a place that's so dark you think you'll never see the light again. You may feel like the world would be a better place if you weren't in it. And people feel that way more than we talk about. I felt that way. We don't talk about it. Our world allows us to connect with one another in ways that we've never seen before. We know so much about each other. I can look at your Foursquare check-ins and see where you are. I can look at your Facebook page and see what you're talking about. I can look at your Instagram and see what you're eating. But unless I ask you and unless I listen very carefully, I might never find out what you're feeling. It's easy to look at all those check-ins, to look at that stream of information that comes off of all of us and assume that everything's okay. But you have to take an affirmative step. You have to do something. We can use our networks to take care of each other in ways that we've never dreamt of. There's a thing I would have said to Aaron if I'd thought to ask, if I'd known what was going on. And I'm sure all of his friends would have said things like this. I never said it to him. I'm going to say it to you because maybe you'll get a chance to say it to someone else, or maybe you'll need to hear it sometime. And it's this. Whatever problems Aaron was facing, killing himself didn't solve them. Whatever problems Aaron was facing, his problems are now unsolved forever. If he was lonely, he will never again be embraced by his friends. If he was despairing of the fight, he will never again rally his comrades with his strategy and leadership. If he was sorrowing, he will never again be lifted up into joy. So it's kind of a low note to end this on. But the high note is, we get to choose. We get to choose if we're going to have technology that makes us more free or takes freedom away. We get to choose if we're going to use that technology to atomize us and alienate us from one another or to take care of each other. We get to choose. And like Aaron said, it only works if you take part. Thank you. So now we have some time for questions. I'll remind you that a long rambling statement followed by what do you think of that is technically a question, but not a good one. And there's a microphone going around, so if you want to give it to this gentleman here. In fact, why don't you take it there? I'll just repeat his question. You work your way back there. Go ahead.
I can speak pretty loud. I'll be okay.
Okay.
Thanks for coming. I saw your webcast at Freedom to Connect last year, but we had a misconnection. So thank you for trying, and thank you for coming today. Also at Freedom to Connect last year, Aaron gave an amazing speech. I encourage you all to look it up. Freedom to Connect, Aaron Schwartz, an amazing video about, you know, the Aaron speech.
I do.
Very good one.
Yeah.
That was a great conference, and one of the subjects that was net neutrality. Can you talk a bit about?
Sure.
The
question is, what about network neutrality? So, let me define network neutrality really quickly for you, using a very sharp example that I like. I first heard it from Craig from Craigslist. He says it came from someone else, so who knows where the credit is due? But here's the thing: imagine you picked up the phone, and you called Tony's Pizzeria on the corner, which makes the best pizza in town. And their phone wasn't engaged, it was sitting there, no one was talking on it. But instead of ringing in Tony's Pizzeria, you got a message. This is AT&T. Tony's Pizzeria has not paid for premium carriage. You can wait 5 seconds and talk to Tony, or press 1 to be connected to Domino's. Right? Net neutrality, or the absence of network neutrality, is the idea that if you are running a network service, that you can slow down or block services that compete with the ones that you've been bribed to carry, right? That's the basic tenet of it. And when you talk to the carriers about it, when you talk to the telecoms about it, they say, well, it's a free market. What do you expect? We paid for those lines. We put them in the ground. And we need the money from them to build more networks and better networks. If you don't like it, build your own network and run it however the heck you want. But here's the thing. The carriers didn't pay to make those networks. Oh, sure, they paid for the copper. But the right of way, right? Imagine if every time you wanted to run a cable through someone's basement or stick a telephone pole on their front lawn, imagine if you had to pay for the privilege, pay lawyers to negotiate it, contract it, paper it over, keep up, you know, the next person who owns the house decides to change their mind and tells you to move your telephone pole or get your wires out of their dirt. Imagine where you would end up, right? It would cost trillions to run that. It would exceed the GDP of the planet to build a phone network like that. So the phone companies are the beneficiaries of an enormous public subsidy. And if they don't want to run the network that we let them put in our dirt, they should get their wires out of our dirt, right? We'll give them 60 days. If they haven't got our wires out of the dirt by then, we'll pay them the scrappage fee. Copper is up. And we'll find someone who's willing to take this titanic public gift and run the network in the public interest. And if they want to run their networks however they want, let them build private enterprise networks where every foot of right-of-way has to be paid for at the market rates, right? And that's what I think about network neutrality. Thank you. Someone in the back who has the mic. There you go. Yeah.
Thanks. Two questions. One about Pacer and one about JSTOR. Still related.
So what about Pacer and what about JSTOR?
Yeah, one about Pacer and one about JSTOR. The one about Pacer being, so Pacer will, for the federal government claims that the vast majority of Pacer users don't have to pay anything for the service. Because if you use, you know, what it deems in its infinite wisdom to be a reasonable number of pages of legal documents, I think it's something like 80 or 100 pages a month, case law, then you're not, you know, that's refunded for you.
Right.
Second question is, I think the Obama administration had said something about maybe they instructed certain agencies to get federal money to do research, to look into making it public.
Sure.
First of all, what does that mean? And
sure. So the first one was what about Pacer? So first of all, it's kind of a tautology to say that the people who use Pacer don't have a problem using Pacer. Right? Like everybody who uses Pacer doesn't have a problem using Pacer, doesn't tell you anything about all the people who aren't using Pacer. And in particular, it doesn't tell you about any of the things you could find out about the law if you could download the whole sucker and start doing analysis on it, which is pretty important. And we've seen lots of, you know, if we believe in the Human Genome Project, we should believe in the American Law Big Data Mining Project too. So that's the first thing. About JSTOR. So yes, the feds say that they're gonna, and the NIH already requires research to go into open access or something like open access after a set period. But there's all the stuff that's already locked away in there, and we can't get access to that. Now there is another proposal for getting access to this that I've heard from a friend of a friend who's working on a law review article about it, and I'll tell you about it because I think it's pretty cool. And those of you who are, I know some of you are lawyers in the audience, maybe you'll run with this. So if you produce a copyrighted work in the course of your normal employment duties, in the absence of any other agreement, that work, the copyright in that work vests with your employer. It's called a work made for hire. So if your job is to write research papers at your university, by default, unless you sign another agreement with your university holds the copyrights to those. And it's arguable that academics who work for universities and write research papers, those research papers are the copyrights of their universities. But when the journal publishers hand you the take it or leave it copyright deal for publishing your article, which you have to publish in order to advance up the academic ladder, which says you assign all rights to the journal publishers and don't have any rights to the article after it's published, they don't send that contract to the university's legal department. They send it to the academic who wrote it. So here's where it gets interesting. What if you could find 10 universities, MIT owes us some favors at this point, to run a class action suit in which they said to all the journal publishers that you owe us a heptillion dollars in DMCA statutory damages, that $150,000 per download per article, and since you don't have that much, we'll just settle for you making it all open access. And what would be really interesting is we put the publishers in the position of arguing that when people produce works for corporations, that they don't belong to the corporations, which I don't think they're going to want to argue. So, Walt Disney, yeah. So it would be very funny to see Walt Disney filing the amicus brief on behalf of the open access. It's one of those things like the Pirate Bay in Finland suing this Finnish anti-piracy group for copying the source code for their website into a Finnish parody website, anti-piracy website, and Finland doesn't have a parody exemption in copyright because the companies that took the source code lobbied against a parody exemption, so they're gonna fight the charge of copyright infringement by arguing that they've made a parody, and if they lose, well, the Pirate Bay gets to take down this anti-piracy site, and if they win, they get a parody exemption in Finnish law. So it's a bit of a Kobayashi alternative. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Maya.
Hi, I'm Maya.
Hi, Maya. I'm a man at Tech at Human Rights Consultancy. Just a couple of quick questions, hopefully.
Sure.
One, why do you think your audience tends to be male, or the parents look like, and like, sort of who your audience is, and the makeup, and what you write on? Two, what specific advice would you give for an individual person who's blowing action against an individual in the government?
Sorry, what was the second question?
What specific advice would you suggest or provide for an individual who is pursuing whistleblowing action?
Oh, against the government.
An individual in the government that resulted in severe depression and some of the issues you talked about.
Oh, not about how to whistleblow effectively, but what to do about the mental health issues.
Both. I mean, more so how to whistleblow effectively.
Right.
But you know, anything related to that as well.
All right, so why do I think my audience is mostly male? Well, I guess when you write books with male protagonists, people tend to, especially I think young adults, tend to empathize with the character and find it easier to empathize with same-gender stuff. I think the other thing, though, is I'm the beneficiary of a weird trend in young adult publishing, which is that there is a story in publishing that only girls read, young adult novels. And so publishers reject boy books pretty roundly and make a bigger effort to publish girl books and promote them, whatever that means. I mean, some of them are very obviously gendered. They're gendered in a way that makes me feel creepy about the idea that my daughter might read them because they're about performing femininity in literature as a kind of training document, books about girls who like shopping, that sort of thing. Some of them are just have female protagonists but are marketed primarily at girls. And so as a result, there's not a lot of books aimed at boys. And one of the things I hear a lot from teachers, librarians, and teacher librarians is, oh, my boys are, quote, reluctant readers. What I tell them is, here's a book that boys will like. And so I'm the beneficiary in some ways of there being a fairly restricted field, right? There's not much competition in the world of books for boys who want to read, but are going through this period of self-definition where they feel awkward about reading a, quote, girl book. So I think there's that. I mean, for the record, I've been to lots of schools and libraries that were packed with young women as well as young men and who were very enthusiastic about the book. So I don't know if the people who turn up at a bookstore on a school night at 6:30 are representative of the audience as a whole or what. It's hard to say. It's hard to get a handle on. I mean, one of the things about publishing that differentiates it from sort of new media is publishing knows very little about who its customers are relative to something like, say, Amazon or Google or Facebook, which kind of knows what color underwear they wear and who all their friends are, right? In terms of what advice would I give people who want to do whistleblowing? Well, if somebody emailed me about wanting to do whistleblowing, I would probably assuming they did so in an unencrypted way from like a webmail account, I would send them a very brief email that said, here's a phone number that you should call me from a phone that isn't your work phone, you should delete this email. And the email you sent me, and I would delete their email. And then I would talk to them about who at the Electronic Frontier Foundation or who at CCC or whatever they should talk to about good security protocol and maybe try and hook them up with Jake Applebaum or someone like that to get them using Tor OTR, which is the off-the-record forward secrecy in internet chat. You can download Tor button, which is a browser that pops up and is by default secure, and then it has a chat mode that allows you to chat in a way so that even if the chat is intercepted and the keys are later known, it still can't be decrypted, which is pretty cool. There's a book came out recently that Jacob Applebaum contributed to called Cypherpunks. And in it, Jake says, the universe likes secrets, right? There is a weird thing about math, which is that you can make a secret, you can encipher a message trillions of times more easily than you can decipher it, quadrillions of times more easily than you can decipher it. There is buried somewhere in the deep mathematical structures of our universe a penchant for secrecy, which is cool if you know how to use it. And so I would basically kind of introduce them around individually. I don't think that there is yet the one great document about whistleblowers. I mean, EFF has some of these and other places have some of these. It'd be great to see it. It'd be great to see it produced and with good links to Tor Hidden Services where you could download binaries of good tools and so on, but I don't think that's there yet. How about the gentleman in the EFF shirt? They're always good for a laugh. Not a ringer, I promise you. Yes, sir, who I've never had any communication with.
So it feels to me like a lot of our legislative battles, the ones that were really popular, are all defensive battles. Do you feel that there are any areas that are particularly ripe where we could actually gain some rights?
So how can we gain some rights? Well, you know, I'm going to give you the Larry Lessig answer to this, because Larry, you'll know, is one of the parents of the modern copyright reform movement, and he's given it up. He no longer cares about copyright. Aaron didn't care about copyright. Aaron had forsworn fighting about copyright. He said it was a waste of time because every time you stomped a stupid copyright law, three more popped up. It's like Baba Yaga. And so Larry has devoted himself instead to corruption. You know, he points out, I think correctly, that the money in politics has made politics worse, and that it's made politics irredeemably corrupt so that we never get good policy that's in the public interest. And so he said, we need to solve this. And being a constitutional scholar, he looks for solutions that may be a little bit weird on their face, but that don't involve having to get a constitutional amendment through or offing through the Supreme Courts to get Citizens United repealed. So he proposed a system of vouchers, that use it or lose it vouchers, that you could give to political candidates that all Americans would get. And the political candidates who took those vouchers would have to forswear private funding, super PAC funding. So you could have all your Citizens United money, but this would dwarf the Citizens United money. And it would make the optimal strategy for any lawmaker to get elected to please voters, right? That's how you could get elected and reelected, to make voters happy, make the largest number of voters happy, which is kind of a cool idea. And he's got a group called Root Strikers, as in striking at the root instead of the branches, called rootstrikers.org, and they need your help too. So that's how I would try to advance an affirmative agenda, because otherwise we're fighting a holding action. I think the advantage of things like SOPA, even though as soon as we kill SOPA, three more pop up, is that it builds a movement, right? It builds the consciousness that we can change things. Go ahead.
There's a lot of content on Boing about DRNs. A lot of times with ebooks, which I don't understand all that much about, but she said a few words about artificial scarcity. Like, for example, if you want to check an ebook out of the library, you only have so many copies, you only have so long.
Right. Well, so here's the thing, right? The fact that you can't check a book out of the library while someone else has got it checked out, is in the context of the grand sweep of human history and the human project, that is a bug and not a feature, right? The universal access to all human knowledge is a dream as old as infinite life extension and alchemy and so on. It's a utopian vision that actually kind of lies within our grasp in ways that it's never lain before, and yet publishers treat it like a bug instead of a feature. And there's something funny going on now where you could never you could never invent libraries today, right? If you went out, assume there were no libraries, if you proposed libraries, the industry would never let you get away with it, right? They're an historical anomaly, and so they don't want there to be library-like rights to ebooks. Instead, they want ebooks that are somehow restricted. HarperCollins has ebooks that disintegrate after 26 uses. So I used to work in libraries. I was a lowly page in the Business and Urban Affairs Department of the North York Central Library, where Nalo Hopkinson also used to work. And my job as the page, in addition to other things, was taping up the newspapers, taping them back together, because we had to keep them for 30 days before the microfiche came in. And I could run a newspaper through 100 sets of hands in 30 days. But HarperCollins says that it's, I have to say, very well-made books. They're my British publisher, or they were until recently, that it's very well-made books. Their digital analog should fall apart after only 26 circulations, which is just absurd. And I think that, you know, the fact that we have universal DRM and ebooks makes them unsuited for libraries. And I think that libraries should just stop buying DRM'd ebooks. Publishing is worried, it's running scared, it's facing huge pressure from Amazon and so on. And it's bullying libraries, which are its evergreen solid gold customers. And so I think that librarians don't understand the cards that they hold. I mean, it's true that in the age of austerity, we've started eating each other, and so sometimes you'll hear people talking smack about librarians. But honestly, is there anyone who can, with a straight face, say, oh, big library. All of those librarians, they got into it for the money, right? I mean, we know why libraries exist. They exist because people are public-minded. They are public-spirited, right? That's they represent that part of our culture. Maybe we'll do one more question.
One more question. And just while we're doing that question, you can get your non-destructible book
right
at the bookstore and get a couple more for young adults that you know. It really is the best way to introduce kids to so many of these contemporary issues. And this is an independent, progressive bookstore, so don't be thinking you're going to go order it later tonight on that A-word place. It's putting independent bookstores out of business. Bruce is going to reach over here, and it'll be our last question.
It has to be an awesome question,
yeah. And when it's...
I'm going to try.
And when you get the book signed, we can quickly get more, but we do have right. time for you to get lots of books signed.
Right.
Thanks. As somebody who's going into library science and our academy...
Thank you. Right.
On a much greater level. How can I approach that in a mindset that will be enduring? And how can we as, you know, future programmers who will be in these roles as caretakers, how
right.
can we
how do you archive rich data format metadata so that it lasts forever? That's a really, really hard question. I don't know that I have an answer for it, except that the thing that I'm somewhat sanguine about is that because computers show no sign of slowing down in their progress, that new computers run thousands of times faster than old computers, which means that new computers can just emulate older computers. So in some ways, we have a certain degree of future-proofing in that whatever environment you build that RDF stuff in, presumably you could run that environment inside the computers of tomorrow like a ship in a bottle, right? In terms of metadata, I mean, I'm something of a metadata skeptic. I wrote an essay called Meta Crap, which is actually apparently trotted out in a lot of library schools.
It is,
yeah. And so I'm slightly skeptical about it. This is an area where I totally differed from Aaron. And this was Aaron's big thing, was RDF. He loved the idea that you could say, show me articles by Aaron that are 30 days old or less that are about tractors, and the internet could understand what you meant by all of those things. I just think that there's like some inherent problems to that. Like, you know, you're a librarian, you know the Dewey Decimal System. Melvin Dewey was weird. He had strange ideas about the structure of knowledge, right? And it privileges some kinds of things and not others. And there's whole Dewey numbers for countries that don't exist anymore, and no Dewey numbers or very deep decimal numbers for countries that have sprung into existence but are nevertheless very important today. And, you know, there are inherent problems to future-proofing this stuff. And so I don't know that I have a great answer. I like David Weinberger's book, Everything is Miscellaneous, as a kind of approach to understanding the difficulty of the metadata problem. I think it's a really, really good book about what happens when you can shelve a book everywhere in the library rather than pretending that it has one true place. So anyway, thank you all for coming tonight.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Economicum Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.